You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
See some movement at the takeoff zone. It's Kelly Slater grabbing rail. A clean entry. This thing holding open. It spits.
When it spit me, I thought it was going to spit me off my board.
Comes out after the spit.
Spits him out.
He's so deep. He's holding onto his rail. Comes out in the spit.
Spit, spit, spit.
We're just spitballing, right?
What do you think, Scott?
That's awesome.
You in?
Yeah, I like it.
All right,
I think
cool.
It's really good.
Like I said, underlying music track, maybe we could change that out. I'm totally open to whatever, but...
Yeah, the underlying music track would be the one thing where it just sounds a little kind of cliche surfy.
Yeah.
You know, which to me is kind of like... I would much rather there... I don't know. I guess the rhythm of the track is pretty good. Like, it's got a good pace, you know? Like, but maybe there's something that you can find that's... different.
Well, that's what I was
or
thinking.
Or that we can find.
Yeah, I'm down for collaborative. I was just thinking rock and roll. Rock and roll is what we want, dude.
Okay, that's fine. I bet there's an AC/DC song or something like that's got like a real...
Yeah, I'm down. Whatever. We'll figure it out. Welcome to the show, Scott Bass.
That's right.
We're live, dude.
Welcome,
that's
everybody.
The brand new
spit.
Intro.
Spit. Spit. We've got a new intro for the show, Spit.
Welcome to
Spit.
We
have a website. Right?
We do, yeah.
What's our new website?
Well, it's not live yet, but we purchased the Spit Podcast and spitpodcast.com. I started building it on a separate platform because we need to obviously point the name servers to the right place and all that.
Yeah.
So, but I did build out the new site. I want to, so like the site map is all, and the site's laid out. I just want to, we need to agree on the aesthetics for the site and all that sort of stuff. So it's there. It'll be ready in a week or two or whatever, less than 2 weeks probably.
Okay. And so we have a new website. We have a new name. We're going to have a new feed shortly, right?
Yeah.
That will everyone
That's
can
part
point
of the
to.
New website.
And this is David and I's new iteration of Spit, the surf podcast.
Yeah. It was funny. We introduced the name last time we recorded. And then a listener Instagram messaged me and he goes, does SPIT stand for something? Is it an acronym? And I'm like, I don't know. It doesn't, but it could be. So I posed the question on Instagram. Do you want to see what people said?
I'm sure I got lit up. Did I?
Why do you think you would get lit up?
I just saw a couple of them that I saw on Instagram and it was like, what I read wasn't real pleasant towards me. But.
The only one that was negative towards you was our buddy JP Curry said, Scott persistently interrupting thoughts.
That sadly is true. And I'm trying my best to not do that through, not just here, but in my life in general.
I was going to ask you, you get that feedback regularly?
I do. And it's the sign of a bad listener. It's not something I'm proud of. I'm trying to make changes to it. There's always room for growth in our lives. And this is just one small area where I could probably listen more. I need to be in the business of listening and not be so pompous and expect that the thought that just shoots into my head needs to be thrown out right away, you know, and for the world to digest.
Well, you have two ears and one mouth, Scott. So you should use them twice as frequently as you use your mouth.
Wow. All
That's right. What I once learned when I was in elementary school, and every report card that got sent home said, David's super talkative every single time. Right. So that's what one of my teachers told me. Anyways, Chris Cote said, surfers pontificating internal turmoil.
All right.
I'm not sure if that even makes sense, but I mean, it makes sense, but
I don't know if we need an acronym. I don't, the answer is there's not an, it's not an acronym. Like we, you and I, no, it is, but I'm just saying that the answer to the guy's question,
right?
It wasn't, we didn't bring it about as an acronym.
So, Surf Podcast, Intercommunicated Tales, So Pitted in Tubes. Sal Mascala said, Surfers Postulating Intimidating Theorems. Surf Podcast in Training, which was a solid little insult. Stoked People, Intelligent Talk from our buddy Tony Roberts down in Costa Rica. And then one of my favorites, actually, because this shows that this guy was a true, true fan of the show. Surf Perspectives, Insights, and Travis Shammockeries.
That's right. That's an old school listener. That's, we had a whole... I don't know if you heard, you probably listened to a few of them, but back in the day we had a whole segment that was just Travis Shammockery of the Week, which we could bring back, which would be a cool thing.
I'm down for that.
Yeah.
Let listeners know what a Travis Shammockery is for those who are pulling up Merriam-Webster right now and can't find it listed.
Well, it comes from a Bud Light beer commercial.
Oh, it does?
Yeah.
I thought you created it.
No. There was a Bud Light beer commercial where the guy's like, that's more than a travesty. That's a Travis Shammockery. And there's some funny. I'm sure you could YouTube it.
Yeah, okay. It's three words. Travesty, a sham, and a mockery.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
When those three combine, like when things are really, really bad, it's a Travis Shammockery.
I thought that, even though it's not in the dictionary, I thought maybe it had made its way into the Urban Dictionary by now, and you were possibly credited as the author of that.
No.
But it's Bud Light, you say?
No. Nothing I do is original. It's all been taken from somewhere else.
Fair enough. So that's catching up from our previous show. I know since then you were in Mexico, right? Can we talk about that?
Sure, yeah.
Is that
a
secret?
Well, I mean, I don't like to name spots, but yeah, I was in Mexico and we got some good waves and I got my fair share of right-hand moments, you know? It was fun.
Yeah, how long were you there?
I was there for a week. We got some solid swell and you know, glassy tubes and just kind of what the doctor ordered, you know, a week of glassy rights, killer fun sandbar rights, you know.
You can't say where you went?
Well, I mean, I was down in southern Mexico,
okay.
Down in the Salina Cruz area. It's funny, when I was there, I wrote a whole piece for this show called whatever, because, you know, you're on a surf trip, you read books, you watch, you know, Curb Your Enthusiasm or whatever, you know.
I love Curb. Dude.
I do too. That's
you
do, just so insane.
Have you watched the whole series, or are you just working your way through?
No, I'm working my way through it.
Where are you at?
Well, you can download the Curb, Larry David's favorite episodes. So I did that. There's like six of them that Larry David specifically picked. So they're from different seasons. So that got me hooked. And now I'm back in season one.
Okay.
And I'm watching, like, I think I've seen the first four of season
one. It's amazing.
Yeah,
it's hilarious. I've been told I'm a young Larry David. Because I'm a little grumpy, like... You know, I'm set in my ways, kind of.
Yeah, so, you know, I think there's a little Larry David in all of us, which
is
why
is.
We all relate to it.
Yeah,
but
totally.
What a great show. Anyway, you can only watch so much of these things or read so many books. I'm reading a really good book, by the way. It's called I Am No One by Patrick Flannery, which I would recommend to those of us that are of the literary ilk. But so finally, I'm like, God, you know what? I forget how I got to it, but I wanted to figure out what my core surfing values are. Like, what are my core surfing values? What are my core beliefs? And so I just started writing, you know, I believe this, you know, and there's a value behind it and so forth and so on. And now I forget why I even got to that.
You said you were going to read it on the show. You wrote it for the show.
Yeah, but there was something that we were referring to that I was going to...
I was asking what location you were at, and you're like,
oh. Yeah. So one of my surfing beliefs is I don't think it benefits anybody to name surf spots.
Yeah.
The only reason I would say, hey, man, I was down here is for my own ego to be inflated.
Really?
Yeah.
My thought was listeners are surfers, and they want to go to cool places that we go, you know.
And I'm okay with that. And if somebody emailed me and said, hey, where did you go? I would say, hey, here I am. But I'm not in the business of... publicly going, hey man, everyone should go here, it's great. And what I'm saying is, you know, there's no upside to make a spot crowded. Like if I tell the listening public right now, hey, go here, I got great waves, well, then it's going to get crowded, and all the people that go there are going to be like, oh, that's a bummer. It's crowded. Yeah. You know what I mean? I mean, we're dealing with a limited resource. So there's this fine line there with that belief, because I'm not the guy that's like, you know, grumpy guy. I want everyone to enjoy the surf and enjoy the waves that I enjoy, and let me enjoy the waves that you enjoy. You know what I mean? But mm-hmm. but I just don't think that, because it's a limited resource, half the fun is going and finding it yourself or talking to friends about where they went. And, you know, I'm all for that. Yeah. I just don't think it's, I just think that it's not in, again, I kind of feel like, why would I tell you exactly where I surfed?
I think saying Southern Mexico and Salinas Cruz area is adequate.
Yeah. I think that covers it pretty good. You yeah. know, like that narrows it down quite a bit. You know, go there and you'll get some fun waves. You well, know? And it, you can find out for yourself.
But it's also more information than just saying Mexico, because it could be Cabo, or it could be Rosarito. It could be anywhere. You know, it could be Mexican Pipeline, you know? So.
Yeah, and I mean, I think out of respect to those people that surf down there, and you know, it's just, look, it's not rocket science. Everyone knows yeah, the no, spots, but.
But it matters, because now we know you're surfing. Well, I guess you already said it, like right-hand sandpoint barrels, which yeah. is different than surfing, you know, whatever, a different sport.
Puerto Escondido, or whoops, spot.
But, so you got shacked?
Yeah, I got one specific day that was like kind of conveyor belt of tubes, you know, where it was just like, get one, come out, get another one.
How
you know,
sick boom, was boom. It?
It was pretty good. It was like 3 to 4 feet with 5 foot sets. You know, it wasn't huge, but it was low tide and draining, and it was breaking kind of behind the rocks, kind of like snapper. So there was only really me that was going back there. Like,
really?
Like the rest of the crew, there was like 6 other guys, and they would kind of sit on the end section.
Yeah.
And I even paddled up to them. I'm like, hey, if I'm going too deep, if I'm catching too many waves, let me know. Like, I don't, you know. And they're like, hey, man, no one else is going up there. Go ahead, you know?
They just couldn't make that section?
They just didn't want to. Because, yeah. you know, there's actually no risk, but it looks risky. Like, if you wipe out in front of the rock, it kind of just pushes you back out to sea, you know? And they weren't just qualified, you know? They mm-hmm. weren't quite good enough or whatever. They didn't have, today, they didn't feel like doing it or whatever. But, so anyway, there was this snapper rocks type moment for about an hour that, where I was just doing laps, just, you know, and I got, you know, I probably got 2 or 3 or 4 really good tubes and
sweet
some closeouts and some wipeouts and all of that stuff too.
Makes know? It all worthwhile.
Yeah, it was pretty good. Pretty good.
I don't know if listeners fully understand, or listeners who don't really go on surf trips, or maybe aren't as deep into it as you and I are, but you look at, maybe you're like, watch the Fiji comp, or you look at surf videos, and you just assume, you're like, oh, you're going to a tropical location where there's barreling waves and you're wearing trunks, oh, you're going to get barreled all week long. It's not really how it works at all. It's a tremendous amount of preparation to get on the trip, firstly. Then once you're there, obviously dealing with airports, board bags, but then once you're there, you don't just paddle out and get barreled. It's like, maybe there's a swell, maybe there isn't. Maybe the swell direction's wrong. Maybe the wind's wrong. Maybe the tide's wrong. You really have to be in the right place at the right time. And then when you are in that position, you have to actually deliver on the goods. And to surf head high barreling waves is very different likely than surfing your home break. So it's like, maybe it's kind of gnarly, or maybe it's bigger, or like steeper than you're used to, or whatever. And then you fall a couple of times, or you kind of get injured. And it's like, to actually get the couple, like you said, it all dwindles, came down to 1 hour where you got 3 waves. So all of the prep and planning really comes down to maybe that 3 waves took place in 30 seconds. So it all comes down to 30 seconds, you know, which is gnarly.
Yeah.
But it makes it all worthwhile. Those 3 waves make it worthwhile.
Yeah. And of course there's the other experiences behind it all, which you know about, like the cultures that you learn about and the people that you meet and the engagement with the region, you know, physically, geopolitically even, you know, like the stuff that you learn about. So, but yeah, you're right. If you boiled it down, not, you know, 8 seconds of tube time.
Yeah, it's a low ROI. But what that kind of, you talking about the cultural experience of it, dovetails with what you were saying earlier, which is go do it. Like, that's part of the adventure and part of the return and part of the reward is the entire experience, not just the 8 seconds of tube time.
Yeah, you know, and maybe this is a good time to segue into these core surfing guys.
Yeah, I'd love to hear them.
That I have. And again, I think that that these are sort of moldable too. Like, I don't know if anyway, I'd be interested to hear what you and what even more importantly the listeners have to say about these. And look, these are my opinions. I'm not saying that this is for everyone. You can certainly have different beliefs and values, and that's fine. I'm not trying to imprint these on everyone and say this is the way it must be. That's certainly not the case. This is just how I feel about
I would
this.
Love to hear them. I've never even thought about what my core surfing values are, to be honest with you. So I'd be curious to
hear. Well, I'll try to go through them, and we can. And if it gets too monotonous or boring, we just change channels a little bit. But okay, so my first one is that I believe that surfing, and by the way, these might seem really obvious too, but these are my core surfing values. I believe that surfing is above all else about having fun. And partaking in the fun, I benefit physically from the exercise and spiritually from being close to and a part of the powerful and inspiring oceans of the world. It is the only time I ever really enter into the food chain. So that's my number one belief, core surfing value.
I would agree with it.
Number two is, and this speaks to what we were talking about, I believe that publicly naming surf spots on Instagram or Facebook or in movies or wherever the public might digest the information is wrong. Surf spots are a sacred resource, and as such, they require protection. And in general, more crowds, more people, is not good for a natural resource. There's a limited number of waves which break each day at that spot. Now, there are exceptions when a spot needs political action, and stewards of that surf spot have asked for attention to be brought to that surf spot. That's fine, but I just feel like, for me, when I find myself naming a surf spot, and this is just me, it's usually for my own self-interest, for ego or pride or self-esteem or validation as a surfer. So I would ask everyone to ask themselves, why are you naming that surf spot?
Yeah.
My third one is that I believe that surfing without a leash makes me a more accomplished surfer. I swim. My sense of the surroundings is heightened. I'm more tuned in. If more surfed without a leash, our collective surfing experience would be improved. Now, I know there are exceptions to that, obviously.
Controversial statement.
It's just my core belief.
Well, it's absolutely true, and I agree with it, but obviously it presents safety issues, depending on where you're at.
Right. There's definitely exceptions to that.
But I'm on board with you.
But in general, if I personally, and I'm not saying everyone, if I personally can surf without a leash, I will, because it makes my experience better.
I agree.
Me personally. Number four, I believe that kindness, tolerance, open-mindedness, and love should be my overriding attitude when in the water, where often, sadly, selfish character defaults take over. Most of my spiritual growth comes from facing my selfishness in the water. Number five, I believe that surfing should be taught one-on-one by a friend or a close acquaintance, perhaps a father or mother or brother or sister, a relative, so that the intricacies of the culture can be excavated, taught, and passed down over a long period of time. I do not believe the vast majority of surf schools meet this ideal. I believe that surfing is a gift, and I'm grateful for it. I believe that every surfer should travel the world in search of waves and adventure, thereby broadening their understanding of their fellow man and the accompanying cultures, geopolitical nuance, and varying lifestyles. I believe that the surf industry consists of manufacturers of products for riding waves. Surfboards, wetsuits, fins, board shorts, wax, leashes, hard goods in general. Custom surfboard building by small individual board manufacturers is the heart of the essential surf industry. And regardless of dollar amounts made, market cap reached, or IPO number made by non-essential surf products, they are not the essential surf industry. I believe that by law, publicly held companies place surfers' interests behind their shareholders, and that sometimes those two interests are congruent, but that is not always the case. I believe that my surfing style is my surfing statement, and that my surfing statement has very little to do with my choice of clothes, shoes, sunglasses, or whatnot. I believe that surfing is dancing, expressive and free without the confines of arbitrary subjective parameters, and much more than a subjective competitive sport. I believe that Tom Curran is the greatest way. Am I contradicting myself?
No, as this is going on, you're getting, I didn't realize you had the depth that you have and the, I don't know, sentimental heart that you have.
I'm an old guy.
It went from like making political statements about companies to now like talking about dancing by the seat of your soul and expressing oneself through the dance.
Preferably to Blue Sky by the Allman Brothers.
Yeah, I had no idea, Scott. This is heartwarming.
I'll just do one more and we'll stop it there.
Well, if it's about Curran, please, by all means.
I believe Tom Curran is the greatest wave dancer of them all.
Wave dancer.
Bethany Hamilton is the most inspiring surfer of all time. And Kelly Slater is the greatest competitive surfer of all time. I'll leave it there.
Wow.
I could go on, but I start to get out of core values and into opinions at some point. So.
Deep, Scott. Anyway, really, really deep.
I'd like to hear yours at some point.
I'll think about it, actually. I'll make a note to maybe next show.
And I'd like the listeners to chime in on that stuff, too. By the way, we do have Spit email. We don't have them set up yet. But
dude, what's your old email?
You can reach me at, the best one actually is scott@surfboardshow.com.
Cool. I'm hello@surfsplendorpodcast.com. So if anybody wants to send their core values, yeah, I'll definitely put some time into it and think of mine. I agree with you about the Curran, maybe the Bethany, and definitely the Slater thing for sure.
Who's more inspiring than Bethany?
I would just have to think about it. Right. I agree with you. She totally is, but I would have to put some more thought into it. I mean, there's a lot of people.
Inspiring?
Yeah. I mean, it's probably not a lot of people. It's actually probably a pretty short list, but there's a couple. There's a couple that I would think about before I threw that out there, but she is for sure inspiring. I don't want to take anything away from her. Awesome, dude. Well, I'm psyched that the trip went well and that you got shacked. What board were you riding down there?
I mostly rode, Matt Biolas made me one of these Shane Beshin rock-ups. It's like a step-up. It's 6'2", 19 and 3 quarters. It's 2 5/8 thick. It's a round tail.
Awesome.
A three fin. It's got two stringers down the sides, nothing in the middle. And it's got some carbon fiber, like nose inlays and tail wraps. Hmm. And I've had it forever, and it works insane. I broke the nose off down there, but because of the carbon fiber, it kind of stayed in. So the nose is creased, basically. But yeah,
you could fix it.
I just rode it. Like, I didn't even fix it.
Wasn't taking on water or anything?
No, maybe a little bit, okay. But whatever.
Yeah.
Board's old.
You know what's funny, too? Like, listening to you read through some of those and kind of some of the conversation we opened the show with, the show's kind of like therapy, dude. When you go through everyday life and you just kind of comment on things or talk with friends, you're never forced to relive that conversation, but based on what we do here and then Instagram comments and stuff like that, people call us out on stuff and it forces you to kind of think about it. And then obviously prepping for the show by preparing something like that forces you to be a little bit more introspective. And I think it's good.
Yeah. I'm a work in progress and I'm extremely, there's a lot of work that needs to be done. Let's put it that way.
Well, you know, that was a creepy laugh.
I know, dude. That was creepy. That was a creepy laugh. That needs to be on the intro.
I will. I'll put that on the intro. Amazing.
Super creepy. We could just do drops all this whole show. You could make a whole
creepy Nicolas Cage laugh coming at you.
Oh, by the way.
Yeah.
Here I am interrupting, but.
No.
This
go.
Brings up a point. Somebody goes, man, your voice. Somebody down there goes, your voice sounds. Has anyone ever told you your voice sounds like Kevin Costner?
Really?
Yeah, and I'm like, no, but somebody thinks I sound like Nicolas Cage. And they're like, oh, don't get that. But
that's funny. Are they a listener of the show?
No.
Oh. Because that's the thing. If they only hear your voice most of the time, then you could draw those associations, you know? The other thing I was thinking about when you were reading those is I've often felt like surfing is arguably the best metaphor for life that exists. Like, these little microcosm challenges that you're faced with while surfing represent these greater truths in life, you know, and where there is, I feel like in life, there is a grand design. Whether you recognize it or not in the moment, you'll reflect on it later in life and just be like, oh, wow, hard work ethic and not taking the shortcut really pays off in the long run or whatever. And when you're surfing, you learn those things instantly, that there's no shortcut. There's no learning how to do the maneuver before you learn how to bottom turn or something like that. And so you learn and you're dealing with Mother Nature. You're enveloped in Mother Nature and you're forced to take your beatings and that sort of stuff. So there's just this like really poetic, beautiful aspect to surfing that if you embrace it, you can kind of learn greater truths, not only about life, but about yourself, which is what you're talking about. You know?
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody's ever really fully represented that or explained that, articulated it. I didn't right now, really. But sometimes great film kind of touches on it, or a great article or even a photograph kind of represents it sometimes, but it's never fully been excavated in the way that I've kind of felt that it exists. I haven't even fully thought it through in my head yet. I'm just kind of working through it.
Yeah.
But good stuff, Scott.
Thank you.
Hey, hard.
You want to know what else I worked on?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, well, you and I and the listeners know this. We've discussed at length about ways to improve the WSL. And so I took what we've already talked about and I sort of boiled it down to what the end user, the fan, what David and Scott and all of the listeners of Spit. I basically looked at the WSL from that vantage rather than from specifically, you know, like a marketing standpoint, like, okay, that sounds good, but can we sell it? I just took dollars off the table and I go, what's the ideal situation?
Agreed.
And the ideal situation is the new World Surf League, where the motto is the surf dictates our future. That's the marketing blurb. The surf dictates our future. We have the world's greatest surfers competing in the world's greatest waves. And it's broadcast to the world via the World Wide Web. Notice the word world used a lot.
No, but I agree. That is, embrace that platform.
And here's how it works. There's 9 events which focus on quality waves wherever they may be found within a given month. So it's not a regionally set up,
okay,
so to speak,
yeah,
tour. The tour is more or less dictated by swell and not by time. Tour infrastructure, logistics, operations are to be rethought and retooled so as to be as light, nimble, and flexible as possible while still maintaining a quality end-user internet broadcast.
Yep.
Bells and whistles are limited for the sake of quality surf and the nimbleness that we've talked about.
I agree.
The production team needs to be lean and mean. There will be an IT chief. The broadcast back-end labor needed to set up the broadcast. A production director, broadcast talent, only times 4, 2 on, 2 off, and a communications specialist. When the swell and winds are more or less ideal, the call is made and the first heat runs within a day, perhaps 2 days. And the entire event can take place in 1 day, but may need 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the season goes like this. From January 15th through February 28th, we focus on the first event at Piahi, paddle in at Jaws. Now, given the vagaries of the swell situation, we may have the event at Honolulu Bay. Or in that 6-week period, it might be at Sunset Beach, or it might be at Mavericks. We focus on the concept of Piahi, but wherever we need to pull, we pull.
Interesting.
And by the way, this doesn't mean that the staff has to stand by on Maui. They're standing by at their homes in Orange County and LA and Santa Monica or whatever. And when it's time to go, we go. So there's the T&E cost is not what you think.
Mm-hmm. And all of those places are relatively close to one another. That's within a 5-hour flight of one another.
Exactly.
Not necessarily 5 hours from South Africa or Australia.
Right.
But
there are some limitations to the concept.
Depending on where you're
located. But in that 6-week period, we anticipate a large wave event somewhere in Hawaii, preferably Jaws. Yeah. And it could be as far away as Mavericks.
But if you're a pro surfer, you're already in those locations anyways. You're probably in Hawaii at that time.
Exactly.
So.
By the way, there's only, right now I have it, so there's only 12 surfers on the tour.
Love it.
In March, you're Gold Coast-centric, focusing on Snapper or Kira. But if something blows up somewhere else in Australia, you go.
Yep.
In April, the focus stays in Australia with Bells, Winky Pop, and Margaret River as the focus. But again, P-Pass could blow up, and we go to Ponape. In May, we do Tavarua. We do a month in Tavarua. We wait for its cloud break. In June, we go to Chopu. We spend a month in Tahiti. Not us. We don't spend it. We spend it wherever, but we go when we see a swell.
Yeah, the waiting period's
a month. July, J Bay. August, Puerto Escondido. The whole month of August, we wait for a massive swell at Puerto Escondido. September, we focus on lowers. But again, who knows? It could be good in Peru, Chicama.
Sure.
October, we're off.
Okay.
November, we're off. In December, the last event is Pipeline.
Obviously.
And the first event in at Piahi, the event in J-Bay in July in the middle of the tour, and the last event are majors. We have three majors, and they're worth more points, and they're worth more dollars. And again, all events are subject to relocation, are dependent on the quality waves to run. The schedule is subject to change. The swell dictates our future. There's also this cool thing called the confessional booth, where because we've sadly, perhaps, although it's not yet in stone, we may have gotten rid of Rosie. Although I wouldn't mind Rosie being one of the four.
No, she's back.
I know, but I'm saying there's only four in the booth, and we have no field reporter. We have to trim.
Well,
so we might just keep Rosie on. She might be one of the analysts.
She's actually in the booth the last couple of days.
Killer.
Kaipo was there for the first couple, and now he's gone, apparently. I don't know what happened to him. Maybe he had an emergency at home, but it seems like Rosie's filling in for Kaipo now, sitting with Blakey. Anyways.
Perfect. There's a little romance brewing there.
No, she's married. They're both married.
That doesn't mean there's not romance brewing. I'm just saying.
Oh, Bass.
No, I don't
Opening
want
up
that.
The gossip section of the show.
No. But it's good for the broadcast for that perception to be there. It's like
she's great for the broadcast.
It's like
no
the
what.
Two the girl and the guy on ESPN Sports Center, Jameel and Michael. They have you sense that there's some sparks that fly. That's good for the broadcast.
Those two are
just
both
flirt a little.
Amazing looking people with great personalities. So
let them
it's
flirt.
Bound to happen.
Yeah, it just seems like flirting. Anyway, so they have a confessional booth report. And what happens is after each heat, the competitor is required to go into the broadcast booth, a small little booth that's shielded from everyone. He puts on the headset and he looks into the camera and he gives his or her breakdown of the heat, any thoughts he or she may have. Now they have to do this or they get fined. And they need to speak for a minimum of 1 minute or a maximum of 5 minutes. If all is quiet, then questions will pop up on the competitor's screen.
Promptings.
And, of course, if they say anything negative, like Bobby Martinez style, they'll be fined. But the idea is to let them open up. And if they don't, then they can say anything they want. By the way, they can talk about the meat pie they had for breakfast.
Sure. This is a full reality TV concept right here. That's what they do on reality TV.
Yeah, maybe it is. Yeah, I saw it on the Dan Patrick show where they go commercial, and then one of the guys goes into what they call the box. It's like the hockey penalty box, and they put on the thing, and the guy goes, "Oh, Dan was a dick in that last segment. I didn't like the way he said this. I didn't like the way he said that." Blah blah blah.
Hilarious.
So that's the idea, is to get these guys, because I think when somebody puts a mic in front of their face in the public and the camera's on them, they kind of just spit out the same kind of. Either
it puts you into a different headspace
exactly.
than when you're in a room by yourself. But I mean, so specifically, the real world back in MTV early days, that's what the show was. Put these people in a house together, and then three times a day, sit them in the confessional box, and they look into a camera and they talk. And that's how those shows were created. And that's what The Real Housewives does today. But now it's with producers and it's lit and all that sort of stuff. But it's the same exact concept. So I agree. It's a great concept. It's proven, actually.
Perfect. The competitor confessional.
Yeah, I love it.
Each guy has to go in, too, winner and loser.
Mm-hmm.
So there's 12 guys. There's five judges. The commissioner is the sixth head judge. It's pretty lean and mean and nimble. And the T&E, again, I'll reiterate, the T&E side of it, where you think, oh, the entire staff has to wait for a month in Tahiti, that's going to get expensive. That's not how it goes.
Yeah.
And obviously, the real bread and butter of this thing is we need a solid forecaster. You know, Kevin Wallace from Surfline, Mark Sponsor from Storm Surf. You know, even look, there's guys like Parsons and even myself or you or a lot of guys that are into forecasting that can pull it off. But you would look to somebody to really be sort of the guy in Southern California or wherever it is that really kind of makes the call. Because what's going to happen is everyone's going to be watching swells around the world and going, oh, they should go down there and do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, bada bing, bada boom.
Yeah, they're already doing it, by the way. Kelly is nonstop doing it.
Right, exactly.
So now he's just bringing the crew with him instead.
Exactly. Yeah. Instead of going, I'm not going to Rio because Tavarua is pumping. Right. They all go to Tavarua and have the event there.
Well, Scott, you won't hear me say this very frequently on the show or outside of the show, but...
not even outside of the show.
You nailed it. You nailed it, dude.
Yeah, I think it could work. Now, look, there's...
I might edit that out, by the way, in post. That would be bad. to be on record saying that you did a good job.
The nature of spit is that there's no post.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah,
that's
this is like, this is this is our own confessional. We're sort of in a confessional booth right now.
You didn't say it on air. I didn't have the mics recording. I was Instagramming at the time. But we're in your car right now.
It's a truck. Thank you.
Yeah, it's a truck. Sorry. We got locked out of Serving Heritage and Culture Center. They told us they never want to see us again. And so we're sitting in the parking lot.
Since our blow up 2 episodes ago, they're like, that's too much drama for this place.
They're like, we had to clean up the blood, dude. It was a hassle.
Yes.
And it was just unsanitary. Right. Well, dude, I think you nailed it. So you synthesized what we've been talking about for 4 years and kind of brainstorming about, and you just pulled it all together, and that makes a lot of sense.
I kind of did. I'm sure there's a lot of stuff we need to comb through, and I'd like to hear your comments on it. Specifically, like, you know, fiscally, how does it, like, if you go, okay, yeah, that's the perfect scenario, but is it fiscally, is it a business? You know, can we do this?
Here's why it is. All the, you're eliminating a ton of cost, firstly, but secondly, the things that they're selling, which is viewership online and eyeballs, do you think anybody's going back and watching round 1, heat 4 from Rio?
Or
round 3, heat 2? Like, no. Nobody's watching anything other than the quarterfinals on, and even among that, they're watching the highlights of it. And so, I mean, even you and I who are deep into it, who need to prepare for this show, I don't go back and watch Chopu from last year. Maybe I will go back and see who won and watch the highlight waves, but that's the maximum of it. So they're using 90%+ of the resources to film and to broadcast what 90% of people will never, ever watch the first time, much less go back and watch a second time. So they need to kind of focus the 100% on the 10%, you know? And on the 10% of things that we're actually going to watch. And you synthesized a way to produce the 10% and to do it cheaper and do it better in better waves.
When you're hiring for a small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. And there's no faster or effective way than through LinkedIn Jobs. Your time and capital are precious, and there is a powerful resource that can help you focus on what you're good at and integrate people into your team seamlessly to help grow your business. LinkedIn Jobs has created the tools to find the right professionals for your team efficiently and for free. LinkedIn isn't just another job board. Everyone is already on LinkedIn with their resumes and references, and now LinkedIn has designed a hiring platform to connect you with candidates specifically qualified for the job that you post about. More than 1 billion professionals meticulously organized to connect people by skill set to help us all advance our position. 2.5 million businesses already use LinkedIn for hiring, and 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. It's that fast, easy to use, and effective. LinkedIn Jobs can help you write job descriptions, filter the right person to you, and give you the tools to help you interview them like a pro. LinkedInJobs.com/surf is where you go to post your job for free. Yes, totally free. That's LinkedInJobs.com/surf to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
Yeah, that's the hope, you know. I agree with you too. I think you brought up the point last time about this. We don't need to put seats on the beach. Mm-hmm. Like
it's an old model.
Butts on the sand doesn't make sense.
It's an old model.
And there's no need for it.
Yeah.
So, you know, what's interesting about this is you'll notice there's no Indo on here.
Well, so I got a comment about that.
Yeah.
Do you want to go? Or?
No, go ahead.
Okay, so I watched some of the free surf sessions at Cloudbreak before the waves got big for this WSL event. And it's a rippable left. And it's like, oh my God, we need a rippable left on tour. We haven't ever had one we haven't had one in a very long time. And it highlights things that we've never seen, like that we don't get to see throughout the course of the year, like Julian Wilson's backside combo. Like maybe we'll see a couple of waves at a beach break in France or Portugal at that time of year, or maybe he'll go left at lowers and get 2 or 3 sections. But this is like 8 sections, you know, or Gabriel Medina going left on a waist high wave. that he can do 10 or 12 turns on. It really opened up a lot. It showed tremendous flaw, by the way, in Nat Young's front side game. Like, Nat Young, he's not even on tour. He's a replacement this year. But I was watching him. I'm like, oh, my God. He looks kind of terrible. Like, his style, the way he's doing his turns, like, yikes. I'm not a big fan. But I love Nat Young when I watch him go right at Bells Beach and Jay Bay, and then when I watch him get barreled at Cloudbreak when it's actually good, all that stuff. Like, I thought I loved Nat Young, and then this highlighted some major flaws in his game. So I just realized the need for a rippable left, which reminded me that last time you brought up Macaronis. So I was like, bang, Macaronis is the spot, and it's obviously Indo, which you just referenced. I think that would be the solution.
Yeah, you know, the beautiful thing about Macaronis is that the month of April we have an Australia focus. It's not too far. I want to say it's 5 hours from Australia to Indo.
Doable.
Or less, maybe. It's probably less. So Macaronis is doable. The thing with Macaronis is there are some logistics issues with this, with these places, which is why, for instance, you say to yourself, and we said this last time, Macaronis has got a resort. You could just set up shop on the resort. Well, now you're getting into T&E, because if you're going to hold down that resort, first of all, they're not going to just kick everyone out when you decide to show up.
People have their trips booked right. A year in advance.
Exactly. And you can't book it for the whole month of May and just pay for it. Now you've gotten,
yes.
Now you've gotten to the place fiscally where you don't want to be. So I'm not sure. Look, I was on a couple of trips with Surfer Magazine where we did a surf contest off of the boat.
Mm-hmm.
This it was in 2001, something like that. It was the
OP Pro
boat trip. Yeah.
Yeah, that was sick. You were on that?
Yeah.
Sweet.
Yeah, and we
Rocky
did.
Rocky won it.
Yeah.
Bruce Irons.
Andy Irons, Timmy Curran, Shane Dorian, who else? Somebody else. Anyway, it was a sick trip. It was a cool trip. Yeah. It was a cool trip, and those guys were ripping. And that's really when we didn't discover Kandui, but we pulled up to Kandui, and it was pumping, and Martin Daly was kind of like, you know, we always look at this wave, but it always looks too fast, and we've had some guys try to get it, and they always end up getting worked.
Hmm.
At that time, the top surfers in the world, and those guys just tore it up. And it was kind of the coming out party for Kandui left, where people were like, hey, if you're a good surfer, this is an insane wave.
Mm-hmm.
And we just happened to get this 4 or 5 hour window where it was just mammoth. And between heats, I got to paddle out. I've surfed it with one other guy, a macking 8 foot Kandui left.
I thought you don't go left.
No, I go left if it's good.
You go left at Kandui, but
I'll go left if it's good.
No Kandui.
I generally don't go left, but if it's a good left, right. I'm going.
When was the last time you went left, just for the record?
Gosh. Oh, and probably in Del Mar a couple weeks ago.
Okay.
Yeah, Del Mar Beach Break. Yeah.
I'm shocked.
No, Southwell.
Anyway, back to Kandui.
Yeah, so
back to the boat trip.
Boat trip thing can happen with this tour, you know, but it's a logistic nightmare, kind of, and we can have the world's greatest surfers competing in the world's greatest waves without a there's plenty of great waves that have logistic solutions, which we need to focus on.
I agree. So, real side note, I heard Aki talking about that OP boat trip.
Yeah.
He was saying, before the finals, or maybe even before the contest started, all the competitors decided they would split the prize money. And so Aki ended up winning the event, and he ended up going back to Australia.
Paid all the taxes.
He got taxed on the full amount, which ended up costing him more than what he came home with.
Yeah.
So I think the event was like 30 grand for first place. He got taxed on the 30K, but came home with 5K, owed 6K in taxes.
Yeah.
I was like, oh no, I took a loss on this thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember that.
Classic.
Yeah, and there was a girls division too. It was Lane Beachley.
Oh, really?
And
I would say Rochelle Ballard.
Rochelle was there.
Megan Abubo, maybe.
Yeah, Megan Abubo and one other. But that was a lot of fun, right?
Serena Brooke?
Might have been Serena. There was all these Matt and Sam George there that were all, you know, Matt's quite a, you know.
Lothario? Is that the word?
That sounds like a good word.
I think it's a character from Shakespeare.
Yeah, he kind of would roam from tent to tent and find, you know, attempt Congress with a woman if it was approachable and doable.
Do tell, dude.
I think I've said all I need to say, that the George brothers, not Sam. Sam's actually Although they're both, you know, known for their ability to charm. Mm. Let's just say that. And I think there was some charming going on. But I could be wrong. I don't want to throw anybody under the bus, although I just did.
You should. It makes for a better pod, dude.
Right, but I don't need to make enemies. The people that know that know. Let's just let the listeners use their imagination.
Fair enough. Well, I like it, Scott.
The waves were fun during that trip.
Were they?
Yeah. We got some good telescopes. Oh, I'm not supposed to name spots. Damn it.
Dude, you did a lot of work down in Mexico. The first 45 minutes of our show came from your Mexico. You need to go on vacation more often, dude. You come to the show so prepared.
For the record, I'm prepared 99.9% of the time.
Who are you kidding, dude?
I'm not kidding.
You're kidding.
I am.
For what? For life?
For,
the show?
No, for the show. I come prepared with takes and topics.
Oh, okay. Okay.
My concern was that I was being too honest. I would come to the show and just go, oh, shit, I don't have anything. Now I've learned I can't do that or it'll be used against me.
Wait, so are you prepared or are you not? Because now you're saying...
The answer is yes.
Okay. Prepared to...
God forbid the listeners tear me a new one.
That's part of the fun.
Scott's
when they tear you a new one, not me new one. By the way, do we want to talk about Laird Hamilton on TMZ or is the story done? I put it in my notes like 2 weeks ago and now I'm kind of looking at it going,
The best thing about the Laird thing is that Healy came to his defense. Did you see that?
I did, yeah.
I thought that was interesting.
Let me set the topic for listeners who are unaware. Laird Hamilton was getting into his truck in Malibu and TMZ caught him and they're like, hey, dude, there's tons of shark attacks in Southern California.
Shark sightings.
Right, sightings, you're right. People are really concerned about being bitten, or specifically the question was, what are the odds of being bitten? And Laird, basically the way that they pitched this article was Laird Hamilton says that women shouldn't go into the water when they're menstruating. That was the headline of the article. Laird's exact quote was, quote, the most common reason to be bitten is a woman with her period, end quote. So I didn't really think the statement was that controversial. I'm shocked that like the internet goes crazy about stuff that is like a non-issue to me. There doesn't seem to be any scientific evidence to support what Laird says. Like there's,
well, how could there be?
Well, you research.
You get a bunch of women that are menstruating and you put them in the water and see sharks attack them.
He said the most common reason to be bitten is a woman with her period. So you would take all the shark.
Why is that?
Well, you would take all the shark attacks and then you would figure out among those people how many of them were menstruating. That's how you would do the research. But there doesn't seem to be that research done.
Right.
However, Laird has spent a significant amount of time in the water in his life. So maybe he just has experience that leads him to believe that. I don't know. But either way, it doesn't upset me. And either way, it doesn't feel sexist. It feels like, yes, blood. Sharks are attracted to blood. That's indisputable.
Thank you.
It would make sense that if you're introducing blood into the water, then that might be a cause for concern. Like it doesn't. No. Why are people upset about it?
First because it's Laird. Second because he probably wasn't as sensitive to.
I disagree. Read the quote was the most common reason to be bitten is a woman with her period. That's not insensitive at all.
Well, I think the better quote would have been, hey, look, we all know that sharks are attracted to blood. As far as I know, that's a known thing. And if you're introducing blood into the lineups, like you just said, then your odds are probably a little higher.
Yeah.
And there's at least one time a month when majority of the women are introducing blood. And you know what? Thank God for it. We love the fact that, you know, women are capable of producing children. You know, that's awesome. You know,
like I don't think you even,
somehow you got to spin it positive.
I feel like you don't even
need
to.
It's
like,
sad that you have
it
to.
It really
like,
is.
Got to go PC on the whole deal.
It really is. I was like,
it's
everything he said, like I said, I listened to it and I go, okay, well, he's not a scientist and he's making a comment that it happens more frequently, but he's not a scientist and he's not claiming that there's scientific research. But the guy spent a tremendous amount of time in the water, so that does make him an expert, and he probably has an opinion about it. Done with that, it wasn't disparaging at all.
No.
One of my favorite things was Surfline reached out to a guy from the Shark Lab at Cal State University of Long Beach, and he said, quote, there's no scientific evidence that menstruating women are more likely to be bitten. There just isn't enough blood. Kids with scraped knees probably bleed more, end quote. And I thought to myself,
that's not
true. You know nothing about either vaginas or kids with scraped knees, because you think one bleeds less than it does and the other bleeds profusely. Kids with a scraped knee doesn't bleed. What are you talking about? Like, so the one expert they went to on Surfline, I just feel like, well, he discredited himself completely, you know?
Wow. Well, Mark Healy backed, I don't have Healy's exact quote, but there was, I think the inertia, or maybe it was, the bitchy beach grit. Okay. I don't know who it was, but somebody
got a quote
immediately from him. Went to Healy and went, what do you think? And Healy's like, you know what? I agree with Laird. He more or less said, I agree with Laird.
Yeah.
So.
Good.
I thought that was kind of interesting. And it was cool that Mark's, because it would have been the easy thing to go, oh, he doesn't know what he's talking about.
Or I'm staying away from it.
Yeah.
I don't even want to touch it.
Right.
No, I agree. And it's crazy, like, Lena Dunham commented on it. Like,
oh, God.
I know. That's how I felt, too. I didn't even read what she said. I just saw that she had an opinion. I'm like, oh, God.
She probably said something like, it's typical of an asshole misogynist like exactly. Laird Hamilton. I mean, she probably just went off on him.
Yeah. I thought it was, the whole thing is hilarious and, like, a sad state of affairs for where we're at.
Oh, God. Oh, well.
Yeah, whatever.
What are you going to do? Speaking of sharks, I saw this morning that pro surfer Kalani Robb, he's a pro surfer still, right?
Sure.
More or less. He and some buddies put a fish on a fishing line attached to a drone and flew it out to the sharks in San Clemente, the Great Whites, and have footage of the sharks eating the fish that they have attached to their drone.
Yep. And they sent up a second drone with it to shoot the fishing drone, because obviously
the fishing drone's gonna
get sunk when the shark takes the bait.
Yeah.
I saw the video. He posted it on Instagram a couple days ago.
It made the news this morning.
Did it?
Yeah. In San Diego, it was on the morning news, you know.
Fascinating. Chumming for sharks with a drone.
Yeah, and obviously the lifeguards chimed in. They're like, well, this is not something we condone. Please don't do this. We've got beachgoers. We're trying to keep them safe.
I think he's trying to scare people away from lowers, probably. He does it at lower.
That
so
was kind of the vibe I was getting. Yeah. Like, why else would you do this? Other than it probably got a lot of hits.
Yep.
You know.
Yeah, a lot of, social media environment. That's an important thing, dude.
Yeah.
What's your experience with sharks, by the way? You've surfed your whole life.
I have none.
Have you ever seen a shark?
I have seen small 2-foot reef sharks in Fiji.
Oh, okay.
And I've seen a baby. One time I picked up a baby great white out of the water at Cardiff Reef.
Why would you do that?
Because it was low tide. This thing was swimming around with us. It was a beautiful spring day, like April. Fun waves, super clear blue water, low tide. This little, maybe 2 feet long, baby great white shark is swimming around. And it's kind of cute. It's like a puppy. It's harmless, right? And it's swimming around with all, and we're catching waves, and it's just hanging out in the lineup, and it's just there. And at some point, it went into the river mouth area there, probably to look for food where there's nutrients. And I happened to finish a wave, and it's just right next to me in literally like knee-deep water or less, shin-high water. And I'm like, oh, look at this thing. And so I just went down and grabbed its tail, picked it up, held it up. And some lady on the beach, yeah, they're like, because everyone had seen it. And I'm like, look, I got it. And some lady on the beach took pictures of it. And I put it back down, and it swam around with us for another hour and then swam up to Swami's.
Whoa.
So that's my experience.
I would not have the impulse to pick it up. But secondly, I would be worried that the parents are somewhere.
Well, here's the interesting thing, right? Sadly, about a week, maybe 8 days prior to that is when the swimmer up in Solana Beach at Tabletops was attacked by an 18-foot great white shark.
Wow.
And lost his life. He was swimming with a group of swimmers, like triathlete types, and they were out there by Tabletops. And he was in the middle, which is interesting because sharks attack the middle. They never attack the fringes. And he got bitten severely on the leg, massive femoral bleed out, and died. And a week later, this baby great white shark is cruising around. Now, the other maybe not interesting part of that story is, when that attack happened, sheriff's helicopters took off and they flew up and down the coast. And at every surf spot, they went over the surfers and hovered. And they went, there's been a fatal shark attack. Please get out of the water. And they went up and down the coastline of San Diego County doing that. Hmm. I happened to be on a long distance paddle, paddling outside the kelp. At the time, I was between swamis and tabletops. And I'm a good 500 yards out on the other side of the kelp beds. And I hear this helicopter. I'm like, what's going on? You know, and I can't really hear what they're saying at swamis. They see me and they jam out to me, hover over me and go, there's been a fatal shark attack. Please come in right away. And then they take off. And I'm like, great. I'm out here. Yeah. There's been a fatal great white shark attack. And they just leave me. And so I scurried with my paddle between my tail. And
so you did actually take heed their advice and get out of there?
Yeah, I think I went inside of the kelp beds and just paddled down to Cardiff and got out.
You know, it...
And then I was on duty. I'm sorry to interrupt, but...
Well, once you get spooked like that, you can't shake it out of your head. Like, I've been surfing, like, in Baja, let's say, where there's nobody really out and around, and it just feels creepy. Once you get that little creep sensation, now every wave that you duck dive, you're envisioning a shark opening its mouth and just enveloping you, like eating you, you know, whole.
Yeah.
And you can't shake it. And then it's just like, I got to get out of here, like as quickly as possible, get on dry land. So I've also surfed since I was like 12 years old. I've never seen a shark, dude. And I'll run into people who are like, oh, I saw a shark last weekend. And I always am very critical where I'm like, dude, you don't surf that much. And I surf that spot all the time and I've never seen one. It probably was a dolphin, which I do see dolphins every single day. But I did. I think I might have told this story on the podcast a couple of years ago when it happened. But I was surfing like a twilight session right before after the sun went down and there was still a little bit of light and there was only two other guys out. It was in Huntington. And they both scrambled for like this tiny little wave, like this knee high. I was sitting out the back waiting for like, it was probably like shoulder high or something. And I see these guys scramble together for like a knee high wave. And I was just like, that's weird. There's nobody out. They should just wait for a good one. Why'd they go together? You know, whatever. And so then within like a minute, a good one came and I surfed it to the beach. And I got to the beach and they were standing there and they're like, dude, did you see that shark? I'm like, no, what are you talking about? They're like, that's why we scrambled out of there. We saw this shark pop up like 15, 20 yards beyond you and just hover for a minute. The fin just hovered and didn't move. And then in a split second, darted straight at you. And I'm like, are you kidding me? They're like, no, we freaked and we bailed. And in my head, of course, I'm thinking, thanks for telling me, you know?
Yeah, why didn't they scream at you?
I don't know why they didn't, but he goes, it was clearly chasing something. We thought it was chasing you. It was probably a fish, but it, like I said, it just came up, sat there, and then went 0 to 60 instantly, right, and then disappeared. And I was oblivious. I must have been looking the opposite direction or something, but they were, and these guys were actually good enough surfers to where I knew they didn't mistake it for a shark when it was actually a dolphin. It was probably a shark. So that was my only encounter, but again, I didn't even see the thing, you know, so yeah. I can't actually say that I've ever seen a shark in the water, but that did spook me. And it made me realize too, I was like, shoot, I didn't even tell anybody that I went surfing that session. I just like went after work just to, if that thing tagged me, nobody would have known. Like how long until somebody would have been like, hey, David didn't show up for work or David didn't whatever, you know?
Yeah.
Like I would have been, or body part rolls up on the beach, you know?
Yeah, so it's weird. I think when sharks, I don't think sharks want to eat us. I think they think we're other food because the general vibe is they come, they chew on you, and then they go, oh, that's not for me. It's just a bone. And they spit you out. By that time, unfortunately, he got your femoral artery and you're done. You bleed out. If they want to eat you, they won't find you.
But
they'll eat you.
Here's the thing. That doesn't make me feel any better.
No, I know. You know what I mean? No, I know. It's actually kind of worse in a weird... No, maybe not.
I don't know. It's equally bad. The point is they're out there and you can still get eaten. Accidental
yes,
or not.
You're in the food chain.
I appreciate that they're not malicious. That's
yeah,
nice.
They're just doing their thing.
It's good to know they're not like, that guy's a dick. I listen to his podcast. I don't appreciate what he said about sharks.
Oh, my God.
Taking him out.
I did see a shark one time, but I wasn't surfing. I was two times. One time between Catalina, I was going to sixth grade camp, and they used to take us out to Catalina Island, Camp Fox, with the YMCA. Between Long Beach and Catalina, we saw a hammerhead. And then another time I was sailing between Cape Verde Islands and Spain. Or, yeah. Anyway, I was sailing in Europe somewhere. And we saw a big hammerhead. I've seen hammerheads twice, just from the boat.
It's fine if they're out there in the Atlantic. I don't ever go there.
Right.
I don't ever go surf there.
Right. Exactly.
Sorry to the listeners who live near Cape Verde. Here's what's shocking, Scott. This has been since we last recorded, there's been more deaths in the surf world than we've ever had in a 2-week period of recording this show. It's been tragedy has struck.
Yeah, I know. It's been at least two, right?
Well, three? I've got three. And then Greg Allman, your man.
Oh, yes. Greg Allman.
He's not in the surf community, but...
No, but he could be.
He's a brother in arms.
He's like, a brother in arms. No, that's sad. Greg Allman had hepatitis C, and he was 69 years old, and that was definitely a bummer. I was lucky enough to see him last year. I saw him at the Belly Up Tavern in Solana Beach, and that was a great show. And yeah, but let's talk surf. I mean...
So... You want me to tell? So, yeah. John Severson,
right,
founder of Surfer Magazine. Can I read a little bit about John
from
Matt Warshaw's Encyclopedia of Surfing?
Please do.
I think he's due this segment of the show. You know, like we need to give him his thorough due.
Yes,
he's an important figure in surfing.
Yes,
he was the founder of Surfer Magazine, but he was born in 1933 in Los Angeles, the son of a gas station owner, actually. And he began surfing at 13 when his family moved to San Clemente, which is where Scott and I sit in this moment. John received his bachelor's degree in art education from Chico State College in 55 and a master's in art education from Long Beach State College, which is actually where I went. Severson's paintings and sketches from this time have been called the original surf art. And after being drafted into the Army in 1956, Severson was stationed in Honolulu and was assigned to the Army surfing team. Surf, his debut film, came out in 1958 while he was still in the military. Surf Safari was another film that followed in 1959. And Surf Fever came out in 1960, which him, along with a group of surf filmmakers, Bruce Brown, Greg Knoll, and the genre originator, Bud Brown, basically toured those films up and down California's coast from Santa Cruz to San Diego, which was really kind of the way that you introduce films to the public back in that day. So his movies were real. If you haven't seen them, they're similar to other films of that era where they're kind of free of plot, but they're just showcasing wave riding with maybe a couple short comedy routines in between. But his handbills and posters that he created for the show were created by him from his original artwork. So really kind of just a one-stop shop. And in 1960, he produced a 36-page horizontally formatted magazine for one of those films, Surf Fever, which was kind of the groundwork for what would then become Surfer Magazine. It all led up to that. So he published four editions of that magazine in 1961. He called it Surfer Quarterly. And the magazine steadily grew from issue to issue, and it was really a one-man show with Severson doing all of the editing and much of the writing, the photography, and the design work. He later hired a number of people who became surf media icons, including cartoonist Rick Griffin, photographers Ron Stoner, Jeff Devine, and Art Brewer, writer editors Drew Campion and Steve Pesman, who went on to found the Surfer's Journal, and graphic designer John Van Hammersveld and Mike Salisbury. In 1971, he sold the magazine and moved to Maui with his wife and two daughters, and for the most part, just returned to painting, sketching, and surfing. His art would eventually be sold in galleries in the U.S., Japan, and Europe, and there was a book published in 2003, which was kind of a retrospective of Severson's work called Surf Fever, named after his film. And in 2011, he received the Lifetime Achievement Award at the Surfer Magazine poll. And he continued to surf all the way up until the age of 80. He ended up dying of leukemia on Friday, June 2nd, at the age of 83.
Yeah, great read. And I'm just trying to, you know, he lived a full life. And I don't think, you know, the one thing I remember as a kid was the way I was introduced to surfing was by the magazines. The magazines got me hooked when I was like 10 or 11 years old. Both of them, surfing, international surfing, I think it was at the time. Maybe it was surfing. And of course, Surfer, which was the Bible of the sport. Mm-hmm. And I just remember waiting for that magazine to come in the, into the mailbox. And it was a big ass deal. Like, it was a huge deal. And that was not my, I was not the only one with that experience. That was the experience of hundreds of thousands of surfers around the world waiting for that magazine to drop in their mailbox.
It was the preeminent media outlet. Like, they're obviously in a time before the internet and even before short surf films like we have now. There was long feature length surf films, but even those were very hard to access. So that magazine was pure gold, you know?
It was. And of course, I worked at Surfer Magazine for 8 years, and the couple of times that Severson walked through the halls as a visitor after he had sold the magazine, you know, 15, 20 years prior, it was like the Pope, you know, like everyone just dropped their shit, stood up. It was very much a big deal in the offices. You knew when he was coming and everyone was on their best behavior. And, of course, he was a super cool guy, but there was certainly a sense of reverence about his visit.
What I love about him is just that he's an artist, you know, like he's a complete artist who was able to gather all that creativity and organize it into a fashion that, he was able to pump out those magazines for a number, like consistently. Like, that's the thing. As an artist, not that I'm speaking as an artist, but as an artist, that's the dilemma, is being able to actually systematically produce your work into a way that is palatable and receivable to an end audience. It's easy to just be abstract and write song lyrics, but never actually produce the song, you know, and produce consistent albums. So he was a guy who was able to harness that talent and put it out there in a way that everybody got to see it and benefit from it. So, and then take a break from it, sell it, and then just go produce art again, which is awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. He had a great life. And, I know that this Friday there'll be a paddle out at Doheny.
Yeah.
I think it's at 10 a.m. Is that right?
I'm not sure on the timing, but yeah.
That just came out yesterday. So if you're in Southern California and you want to celebrate the life of an extremely influential man, John Severson, Doheny State Beach, I believe 10 a.m. this Friday, which would be June 9. So, yeah, sad to see that news, but 83, lived a full life. Leukemia, probably not a good way to go, but I'm sure
that.
But
he surfed up until the last 3 years, which means he was in relatively good health. You gotta be healthy to surf.
Yes.
The other major death in the surf community was Jack O'Neill, actually on the same day.
Whoa.
Yeah, and Jack O'Neill died at age 94.
Wow.
So you can't be sad about that. He lived a good life. And Jack O'Neill, obviously, inventor of the wetsuit, the O'Neill brand.
The leash, or at least...
I heard his son. I looked that up. I guess his son invented the leash, technically.
Maybe.
Yeah.
But Jack O'Neill lost his eye to it.
Oh, is that the connection?
Yeah. The eyeball patch is because of the leash came back and hit him in the eye, took his eye out.
That is the ultimate irony.
Yeah.
His son invented the leash, and the leash took his eye out.
Yeah, what I'm reading is that he and his son together invented the leash, but I don't, you know, that's nitpicking, isn't it, to refer to Spinal Tap.
Wow, I did not know that. I always wondered, the guy is a badass. Like, in terms of just, like, a visual kind of look, he was radical looking. He looked like a pirate. He was a proper pirate in the modern age, with a big beard, bushy hair, living up in the, you know, Santa Cruz, kind of a frigid, rugged environment, and then an eye patch. Dude's radical.
Yeah, he was quite the look, you know, there's no doubt about it. And a little bit of a pirate vibe going there for sure.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan.
So, well, we're saddened by the loss of those three individuals. Yeah, I'm reading here that O'Neill lost his sight of his left eye in 71 after his leash tethered surfboard snapped back and hit his face. The surf leash, ironically, had been invented the year before by Pat O'Neill, Jack's son.
There you go.
So, yeah.
That is super ironic. By the way, that is a very dangerous thing that can happen to anybody. I had that exact thing happen. either wiped out or kicked out of a wave, and like the leash hyperextends, which creates a rubber band effect. And I was like turning to look back towards the beach where the board was. And as I was turning, the thing hit me in the side of the head, right at my earlobe, and split my earlobe in half.
Oh my.
Yeah. It was Thanksgiving morning, like maybe 10 years ago. And, it felt like a punch to the head, because right behind your earlobe is your skull. And so it felt just like a punch to the skull. And I was immediately like kind of debilitated by the blow and held my hand up to my head and was just like, oh, I just felt the pressure. I didn't know it was a laceration. And as I was holding it, trying to like recover for a second, I then looked at my hand and there was blood everywhere. And I'm like, uh-oh. And I was surfing with my buddy Grant, who, you know, Grant Ramey, remember him?
Yeah.
And I look at Grant and I'm like, dude, how bad is it? And he like, his eyes get all wide and he's like, we should probably go. And so like, we're on the beach walking, and it was like this long stretch of like super long beach. And we're walking up the beach and he kind of keeps glancing over at it. And he's like, we should probably jog up the beach. And as we were jogging, I could feel the earlobe like flapping in the wind. And it was, I ended up going to urgent care and having to get it stitched up. And I showed up, of course, late to Thanksgiving at my dad's house with my ear all stitched up, still wearing the clothes from surfing that morning, because I had to go straight to my dad's from the urgent care. And I had blood all down the shoulder of my shirt while I was sitting at Thanksgiving dinner. It was pretty radical.
Nice. Nice look.
Yeah. So, but that always made me aware, like, when you feel that tension on your foot, give into it. Like, don't fight it and pull your leg back. Let it pull your leg and stay underwater for an extra like 10 seconds.
Yeah.
You know, because it's dangerous.
Good advice.
Yeah. Although I wouldn't mind having an eye patch at this point. If that was the
result.
You could
get an ear patch.
Ooh. Yeah, not as cool. Not as cool with the ladies, I don't think.
Remember that footage of Tom Curran surfing in, actually he was down in mainland Mexico, and he had socks on his ears to cover his the sun, so he had the socks drooping. He looked like a little puppy dog with like wet hair.
He had a safari hat and then the socks attached to that.
Yes, crazy.
And
good,
he was
look
wearing pants,
and he only wore that outfit when he rode the little skimboard boogie board thing.
I like, think it was prior to the skim, it was a boogie.
Yeah, it was a boogie.
He was standing on a boogie.
And then when he went surfing on his normal board, he had a whole different outfit. Like, he specifically had an outfit for the boogie.
This guy's our hero, dude.
He is. There's nobody better than Tom Curran. I am sorry. That guy is the ultimate wave dancer.
Hashtag wave dancer.
Hashtag wave dancer.
I got to say, I saw that footage and immediately I questioned everything I knew about Tom Curran. I was like, wait a second. I might have to just reevaluate this guy, because that is a ridiculous outfit. And then I saw him stand up on the boogie and shred, and I go, well, I guess I'm going to be buying socks for my ears now and wearing pants in the lineup, because I am clearly wrong. And I need to reevaluate all of my fashion choices now, because this guy is the ultimate badass.
I'm sure the product and development team at Stance Socks is like, oh my God, we are legit.
All right, guys, boardroom meeting Monday. We're developing ear socks.
Yes.
Here we go. And I actually saw Tom here. We're at the Surfing Heritage and Culture Center. Saw him here last year doing a thing. And he was drinking a Pepsi, and it made me laugh. I was like, I don't know any other adult who drinks Pepsi, and especially out of a can, but you don't?
No, why is that random?
I don't know, dude. Is soda a part of like your regular life?
Not me personally.
Not me either.
I don't drink sugar drinks.
But that's what I'm saying. I don't know anybody really that's drinking soda at this point as an adult.
But I've had a Pepsi when you and I have done the show. I've drank a Pepsi when
I was. Okay, I'm just saying it was...
Pepsi's not that far off the norm.
Here's the thing. I expected a beer or a bottle of water.
Right.
And I would have even been okay with, like, I don't know, a I mean, what if it was like a Jones Cola? I was like, just something like
something
niche
off
and cool.
Right.
The fact that he's drinking a Pepsi just made it so weird, but also so Tom. I was like, I guess I got to start drinking Pepsi now. He knows something I don't know, and I'm a huge fan, so...
Yeah.
That's the power of advertising, by the way. That's why companies hire LeBron James and pay him millions of dollars, because me just seeing him do that made me want a Pepsi.
You're going Pepsi on us, thanks to Curran.
Yeah. Anyway, what else you got, Scott?
That's all I have.
Well, I got must-see moment, Duke and Kook and all that. Should I go straight into it?
Yes.
My must-see moment.
Michelle Perez's
stall. Oh my God. That's my must-see moment.
Well, thanks. Thanks for biting. Like you said earlier in the show, you just bite off other people's.
No, that's but that's everybody's must-see moment. Dude, that's pretty rad must-see moment. Yeah, ridiculous. That's
ridiculous.
So cool.
You want to explain it?
No, no, go ahead. I'm sure you've got it.
Well, Cloudbreak was pumping. We didn't even talk about it yet, but the Fiji Pro is taking place. We're finished round one and round two. And Michelle Perez, in his heat, got like a pretty sick 8 to 10 foot barreling wave. And while he was pig dogging in the barrel, it opened up before he went into the second section. So we got a glimpse of what he was doing in the barrel. And pig dogging, meaning he was backside holding the rail, but he made an adjustment to it. He took his back foot off of the surfboard and dragged it in the wave's face while he was on this freight train. So he had his left hand dragging in the wave, which is a way to slow down, but he then additionally picked up his back leg and dragged that in the wave, so he only had 2 points of contact on the board, his front foot and his right arm holding on to the rail, and his left arm and his back leg were
right
stalling.
Foot.
His right foot was using as a brake in the wave face and on an 8 foot freight train.
And he was kind of letting in and out of the back foot brake, too. It wasn't just, like, slamming it on. He kind of adjusted it as it went.
Yeah.
And it's amazing.
So it was a back leg stall. It was ridiculous. Even the commentators in the booth, Ronnie Blakey and Rosie Hodge at the time.
That's right, Rosie.
Tripped.
Yes.
They were watching it. They're going, oh, he's getting barreled. He's going to come out. Wait, what? What's he doing? Oh, my gosh. He's using his leg to stall. And then he got blown out. They're like, that was insane. I've never seen that before. They both had never seen it before. They were tripping.
Yeah.
So it was really radical. That's the must-see moment. Michelle Perez, in his post-heat interview, wasn't that – he was, like, shocked that they were impressed by it. He goes, oh, no. He's like, I do that all the time at Chopu. Like, when I want to slow down and my arm isn't slowing me down enough, I use my leg. He was like, oh, yeah, no biggie. Kelly Slater was later interviewed in the wrap-up at the end of the day. He said that he saw it at Makaha in 1992 by a guy, and they called it the Allen Wrench. Hmm. And so I don't know if that surfer's name was Allen, or maybe his last name was Wrench, or maybe his name was Allen Wrench. I don't know. Why would you call it an Allen Wrench?
I don't know. If he's at Makaha, I'm sure his name had... It's probably like Bird Boy or Buddy Boy.
Or Allen Wrench, maybe? I don't know. So Kelly needs to elaborate on that, but he did see it in 92 at Makaha. I actually saw somebody in the comments section, maybe on Stab or something, mention that they saw Ryan Turner doing it in Indonesia, I think they said, which jogged a memory for me. I've actually seen Ryan Turner do it as well in Huntington on big days. In the wintertime on Southside, there's like a left against the pier that runs barrels straight into the pier. And I might actually have video footage of it. I'm going to need to dig it up. But on those big barreling days, nobody can even make the paddle out. There's a couple of Huntington dudes, Ryan Carlson, Tom Resvin, and then, of course, Ryan Turner, who just charges. You won't see him surf for a year, and then you'll see him show up at the wedge and get the best waves of the day, just charging. And he'll be riding like a 7 foot board. And so I do remember seeing Ryan Turner doing that as well on double overhead waves at the pier. So it's been done. But even when I saw Michelle Perez doing it, I had kind of forgotten that I had seen it in the past. So, but it's radical, super technical, super technical.
So it's got a name, too. That's kind of cool. It's the Allen Wrench.
Well, according to Kelly.
Well, that's good enough for me.
It's good enough
it
for
needs
me
a
too.
Name. Let's give it one that Kelly suggests.
It's a good point. They came out of Makaha in 92.
Yeah, like, I'm
point.
Not going to argue that.
Fair enough, Scott. Fair enough. You're making a compelling argument.
The Allen Wrench. Done.
Yeah. So I will say also the women's Fiji Pro, we need to touch on that. Courtney Conlogue beat Tatiana Weston-Webb in that event. And they ran most of the event in marginal surf and then decided to hold off on the final. And they actually went past the women's waiting period and ended up running it in the men's waiting period, knowing that there was this amazing swell coming. So they ran it in 8 to 10 foot cloud break, which, you know, basically put the women to test. Like, Courtney and Tati had to charge out there, and they did charge. They ended up Courtney winning the event without really getting barreled, which was a little bit of a, I don't know, an asterisk that needs to be put on that final. It was a low heat scoring final. I think she won with like a 10 point total. Courtney opted to try to do turns. Tatiana opted to try to get barreled, which she did. She just didn't make any of the waves. And this is what I really want to discuss. This isn't to shame the women or to say, I think it's also not to patronize the women and be like, oh, they charged when they ended up winning the event with a 10-point heat total. I don't think that's right to do either. So I'm going to call it out where I see it. And that is, yes, they charged. Yes, Tati picked off barreling waves and pulled into them. But the point of difference between the men and the women is she's not navigating the barrel. She's pulling into the barrel and she's charging, but she's not navigating and threading. So when you watch Michelle Perez not only navigating, but doing this super technical backside drag, foot drag, and then feathering the throttle while he's in the barrel, that is the point of difference. So it's great that we're on this point of watching the women's surfing evolve at this really high level, and we're putting them in these situations that allow them the opportunity to evolve, but we're going to need to see you thread the barrel. Like, no doubt Tati can pull into perfect cloud break and get tubed and come out. She won the GoPro entry last year for doing that at big cloud break, but it was a little bit of a sketchy day where it was very big, but it wasn't perfect. So what we need to see is you pulling into the imperfect wave, feathering the throttle, driving through the barreling sections, stalling when it's perfect, driving when it's not, and pulling up high and coming out of the almond part of the barrel when it calls for it. That's what we're going to need to see.
Well, good commentary. And that wave requires that you turn in the tube to make it out. There's right. One section that's guaranteed just stand there, but for the most part, you do have to turn your board in the tube to, as you say, sort of negotiate.
Yeah. Well, moving on to Kook and Duke, my Kook of the week is a 19-year-old girl driving under the influence who hit and killed surfboard shaper Paul Burke.
Wow, that's so sad. That's such a bummer. I did see this.
It's such a bummer, dude.
Yeah.
I mean, so Paul Burke, 59-year-old surfboard shaper who's, I think, living in Oceanside for kind of main part of his life, or adult life anyways, raising his family and stuff. But he was 59 years old. He was actually from Long Beach, California, which is where I was born. It's where Dane Reynolds was born. Brett Simpson, we're all born in the same hospital. Greatness comes out of Long Beach Memorial Hospital, Scott, in case you're unaware.
I'm sure it does.
Tim Stamps still lives in Long Beach.
Okay, you've mentioned one great guy, Tim Stamps.
No. What do you got against Dane, dude? Come on.
Nothing. Dane, too. That's two great guys. Oh, and you, that's three.
No love for Simpo, I guess. Anyways.
I love Simpo, too. That's four.
There you go. So Paul Burke, surfboard shaper, was riding his bicycle outside his home when, like, he was a cyclist, actually. So it wasn't just he was on his beach cruising. He was actually a cyclist who regularly rode his bike to stay fit. He competed on the ASP. He started surfing shapeboards in the 80s in Laguna Beach, built boards for Brad Gerlach, a bunch of guys. He's just a lifelong surf community dude. And he was hit by a 19-year-old driver who was suspected to be under the influence. So this is Kook of the Week is the driver. This is my PSA. Do not drive under the influence, folks. Whether it's drugs, whether it's prescription medication, whether it's alcohol, whether it's texting while driving. Like, it's so sad that when you see these stories, they're completely avoidable and it's just senseless. It really is senseless. It's so sad. Dude's just riding his bike. Gets clipped by a 19-year-old.
Yeah, that's a bummer, man.
When you're that young, you don't understand the gravity of the situation. And we were all that age. It's just to have such a senseless and life-changing thing happen is tragic.
It sure is.
I'm going to go out on a high note, though, with my Duke of the Week. I have two Dukes, Fabio Cantu and Troy Joner. Troy Joner. This happened on Wednesday of last week, May 31st. They were flying from Melbourne to Nias. And according to Troy, 10 minutes after takeoff, a passenger on the plane stood up and refused to sit down. He ran down the aisle and towards the cockpit with a device he claimed to be a bomb. He was going to blow up the flight with these two Melbourne-based surfers on their way to Nias. So Troy said, he told the Sentinel, he goes, quote,
we sat there stunned at what we had just heard. I could see the panic starting to set in with the other passengers, and I could hear the cabin crew talking in a different language with panic in their voice. We were scared that there was a bomb on the plane and the man was going to blow us up. We both feared for our life. So a female stewardess placed herself in front of the man and the presumed to be bomber, and he actually charged right past her. So I got up, I grabbed him by the neck, I put him into a chokehold, and my buddy, Fab, was right behind me, and he grabbed the passenger around the torso and wrestled him to the ground. I saw a black device about 40 centimeters around and 6 inches in height. I ripped it off of his chest and passed it to a nearby passenger. Other passengers jumped up and helped secure the man's leg, and the cabin crew showed up with cable ties, and we fastened it to his arms and his back and fastened him to the frame of a seat. The captain turned the plane around for an emergency landing back in Melbourne. At this point, the fear wasn't over. Even though he was fastened to the seat, the crew and the passengers all believed there was still a bomb on the plane. Turns out it was all a hoax and it was a fake bomb, but the guy was nuts. And so,
was he an Aussie national, the bomber guy?
I don't know. But Troy said, quote, "Although since we've learned it was all a hoax, the trauma and the stress are all very real for everyone who is on board. So now we just want to go surfing," end quote.
Wow. Yeah.
So shout out Fabio Canto and Troy Joner.
That's
for
cool.
Diffusing a hectic situation on their way to NEOS.
That's a good story for sure. I love it.
Yeah, Dukes of the Week.
Sadly, the Owen and Gabe are out of the event.
I know, it is sad.
Remember we were arguing last show about which one we should keep on our team. We both kept Owen.
Yep. They were actually both on my team, so.
Oh, you were trying to like BS me so that your team could
trying to smoke screen you. But yeah, tragic. Owen lost. I don't know actually who Owen lost to. I forget, but Gabriel lost to Italo Ferrer, who was also on my team, so I'm okay with that.
All right. Well, fair enough.
Yeah.
All right. Well, look. It feels like we had a good show.
Sure feels that way.
We're going to...
I'll go out on the Allman Brothers Blue Sky.
Blue Sky.
In honor of Greg Allman.
Play it all. Play the whole song.
Play the whole seven.
This is the greatest
anthem, right?
I think it's about 5 minutes. It might be seven. But this is the greatest, I think, surf film song ever. Like, if you could...
Although it was never in a surf film?
No. But it would be great. Let me rephrase that. Help me out, David. This song should be used in a quick 7-minute edit of like Craig Anderson, Rob Machado, Tom Curran, and Dave Rostovich.
Where?
Desert Point.
Threading
barrels. Yeah, Blue Sky.
Yeah, like undersea level barrels. Like
with some maybe some artsy camera, like some film, you know, like some artsy
16 mil.
Yeah, exactly. I need a little of that grainy vibe going down.
I like it.
Some of that.
I could see it right now.
Yeah.
My brothers, sing us out.
All right. Well, until next time, we're looking forward perhaps today the Fiji Pro runs. Outer known Fiji Pro, we should say. And until next time, adios and aloha.